Morning, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. You can also check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Facebook is the best way to stay connected. We're trying to hit 12,000 fans, so let's do that. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us right now, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, that theme means that it's Monday morning. It's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Colin Suter, who is taking a little time off, and Eric Childress and I, week after week, review the movies every Monday morning, talk about the box office and other stuff. Colin's taking a little time off, so Jim Leskowski's been joining us, and Jim is going to fill in for Colin again this week. And in addition to reviewing the new movies and discussing a little bit of the box office, we will also talk about the Sundance Film Festival, which Eric attended, and we'll get a wrap-up of that since he is home now from Utah. All right, we will jump to the phones here, and let's talk to Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And here is Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hello, Nick.
All right. Listen, before we get to the regular movie reviews, you know, Colin, one of the things that Colin sort of specializes in, both on, you know, the intranets and on the show here, are short films. Now, have either of you seen any of the Oscar-nominated shorts which are being screened this week at the Century?
No.
Unfortunately not. I haven't gotten out to see them, but I am planning on it.
Okay. I've got a list here of from Colin, ranked best to worst for the Oscar-nominated shorts. And you can check them out at the Landmark Century Center Cinema, which is on Clark and Diversey in Chicago. And I always thought that this was a pretty cool thing. I wish there was a possibility for this to have happened years earlier, because you know, years ago, if you were filling out an Oscar ballot for a pool,
yeah,
you're just guessing. You know, you look at the subject matter. If it's like a serious subject matter or something, then you go, well, that one will probably win.
Yeah.
But now you get a chance to look at them, and I think that's great. And the Landmark Century Cinema does that every year. So you can go there. You can see the live-action short films, which covers live-action regular and live-action documentary, and the animated short films, which, interestingly enough, there is an animated documentary, which is kind of strange. This is what Colin had posted on his Facebook page. It says, the Oscar-nominated short films rank best to worst. None of my favorites will win, most likely, he says, but mostly good selections this year. So he liked most of them, and mostly a positive program for these. But for live action, he's got Everything Will Be Okay as number one, Day One, number two, Stutterer, number three, Shock, number four, and Ave Maria at number five. In documentary, he's got Girl in the River, Price of Forgiveness as number one, Claude Lanzmann, Spectres of Shoah, number two, number three, Chow Beyond the Lines, number four, Last Day of Freedom, and number five, Body Team 12. And then for animation, he's got number one, World of Tomorrow, which I've seen and is great.
I've seen that.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. It's absolutely great. Number two, We Can't Live Without Cosmos. Number three, Prologue. Number four, Bear Story. And number five, Sanjay's Super Team, which I've seen and is good. So
yeah, I saw that one too.
Yeah. That's a Pixar. That's the some from Pixar. So those are the ones that are in there. And, you know, maybe we'll post this list on our Facebook page so you guys, if you're interested in going to the Landmark Century at any time this week, that at least is the order in which Colin liked them. And Colin really does love to talk about short films. And he programs them for the Chicago Critics Festival, correct, Eric?
Yes, he certainly does. And he's actually got a little bit of a streak going now. for the past 3 years, each festival, he's picked one of the films that eventually got nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, well, I think World of Tomorrow is one of them.
That's one of them, yeah.
And so nice job, Colin. And, you know, Colin will be back sometime in March. And, Jim, by the way, you're doing a great job, buddy.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. That means a lot.
No, it's great to have you here, and we really like it. And you're doing a terrific job.
And Colin will actually be on with me. We're going to record in about 10 days for the Directors Club podcast. We're going to talk about George Miller, man.
Oh, boy.
yeah.
Well, if there was one guy who worships George Miller more than I do, it's definitely Colin.
Right, exactly. That's why I thought it would be good to have him on.
Yeah, okay, cool. That's cool. That's great. And so that'll be, you guys are going to record that, and it'll be available. Tell everybody about your podcast network there, Jim.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's over at nowplayingnetwork.net. It's just mostly pop culture-related podcasts at the moment. And, of course, Jim Henke's podcast, Vinyl Emergency, has a new episode just posted. And it's actually, I think, his best interview to date with a guy by the name of Eric Grubbs. So I'm very proud to have helped Jim out with that show. And, of course, my own show, Directors Club Podcast, is on there. And Eric, we'll be working on your show in the weeks to come. So
yeah, I'm going to be working on mine this week sometime. I'm back from Sundance now, so about to start getting it put together.
All right, that's great, yeah. Man. That's really great. I hope people check it out. Okay, well, let's get started. Let me start off by asking, you guys did not see the Kung Fu Panda 3?
Nope.
No.
Okay, well, I'll take care of that one really quickly. It is the continuing story of Po, who is voiced by Jack Black. And in this, for those of you who have seen the movies, you're familiar with Po. Po is this bumbling, sort of lovable panda who excels at kung fu and lives with his adoptive father, played by James Hong, voiced by James Hong. And he gets together with a bunch of other characters, and they fight bad guys, and they all know different types of kung fu. And they were trained, or at least he was trained by a character played by voiced by Dustin Hoffman. And then you got Jackie Chan, and you got Seth Rogen, and Angelina Jolie. They all like play one of the. They all represent the different powers that they have as a unit of kung fu fighters. Well, in this one, he gets reunited with his real dad and goes back to his home with other pandas all over the place, and it's the first time he's ever really encountered this. And there is a new villain played by J.K. Voiced by J.K. Simmons, and he becomes a new threat. Bryan Cranston also joins does a voice in this as well, and he is going to now he's going to Poe is going to go back and train his relatives to become kung fu experts and battle the bad guy. All right. These movies have been of diminishing quality since the beginning. I really like the first one. Did you guys like the first one, Eric? Did you like the first one?
Yes, I did.
And Jim?
Yes.
Yeah.
I did too. Mm-hmm.
I actually really liked the first one. I thought the first one was pretty great. And the second one, not so much. This one, even less. Now, and I also look at the box office, Eric. It was number one at the box office, but it also, in terms of box office, is having diminishing returns, correct?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. At least here in the States.
Okay. $41 million it made. And what did the second one make when it opened?
Second one made high 40s, I believe, so like $48 million.
Okay.
The first one did 60-something, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you did write about this box office piece, which you do for movies.com as well.
Yes.
Although it did make $41 million, and it might be the biggest, is it the biggest January opening?
It's the second biggest true January opening. If you don't count things like American Sniper and Revenant and things like that, which are technically December releases.
Right.
Ride Along, the first Ride Along barely beat it.
Okay.
So, but it will be the highest grossing animated film ever to open in January.
Yeah, when I saw that it was opening in January, I don't know why I thought that was odd. I thought for sure that this would be like a May release or an April release.
I think it's just them testing the waters again. It's just like, they see there's no family films in the marketplace. It's, more than a few weeks past Christmas when holidays are off. So they figured, well, we'll just monopolize for the family audience at this time. And I just I don't know if that's the best strategy in the world to open a movie like this in January.
Yeah.
But they figured that, well, the last one opened in May and kind of, did $50 million less than the original. Maybe we could, increase that if we open it here in January. Yeah. But it's not even going to make the what the second one made.
If you're going to do that, make a better movie. That's the thing. It's just not very good.
Yeah.
Like the Shrek movies, they get worse as they go along.
Right. Right.
And this one, there's not a lot of imagination to it. It's not nearly as funny as the first one. There are moments in it that made me laugh. Some of it is clever. Some of the voice work is great. J.K. Simmons in particular is terrific. And I really like what Dustin Hoffman does in these movies as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jack Black is perfect, you know, is the perfect voice for this, for Poe. But it's just, I mean, I guess kids will like it. The kids that were in the theater that I saw it in seemed to be having a good time. You could do worse. And like you said, Eric, you could do worse because there's really nothing else out there for the kids right now.
Right.
So I'm not going to recommend it. But, you know, if you take the kids to it, it'll be fine. It's, you know, it's only like 90 minutes long anyway. So, but not very good. At least easily the weakest of the three. Okay, you guys, hang on, and we'll jump to the other movies.
All right.
Hold on a second. There's Eric, and there's Jim, and Colin. If you want to see his list, we'll put it up on our Facebook page at some point. If you want to see the list of the best to worst short films, Oscar-nominated short films that you can see at the Landmark Century Center Cinema. Okay, more movie reviews coming up here on a Monday morning on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's a Monday morning. That means it's jokey time a little bit later on, as we do every Monday morning. And every Monday morning, we review the new movies, take a look at the box office. And this Monday morning, we will get a wrap-up of the Sundance Film Festival. Eric was there this past week. We got a live report from him a couple of times this week, and we're going to get a wrap-up from all the movies that he has seen at the festival. But let's get back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski, filling in for Colin Suter, are here. And welcome back, gentlemen.
Hello.
All right, Jim, why don't you start us off again here with Anesthesia, which looks like a pretty interesting film, interesting cast, and the director is an actor named Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah, he's a guy whose films, especially his early films, I really gravitated towards. I really liked. This stars Kristen Stewart, Sam Waterston, Michael K. Williams, Gretchen Mol, amongst many others, in a very sort of crash Paul Haggis ensemble drama where different stories are interweaved. Waterston plays a professor who is coming up on his last day of teaching after nearly 40 years, and his son, played by Tim Blake Nelson, is going through an issue of his own where he finds out that his wife has cancer and needs to have surgery immediately. Meanwhile, a student played by Kristen Stewart is dealing with self-inflicted burns and trying to come to terms with her own depression. And she just is dealing with some heavy stuff. While this is happening, Gretchen Mol is a suburban housewife who's getting tired of her husband running around on her. And there's also another subplot involving an acclaimed writer who is suffering from an addiction to heroin, one that his brother, played by Michael K. Williams, wants to resolve and fix as soon as possible. So a lot of these stories revolve around people trying to numb the pain away, hence the title, and becoming addicts, or at the very least dealing with depression at a very tumultuous time. The problem here is that you only have 90 minutes to tell several stories with several characters, so a lot of things kind of go unexplored, and as a whole, it's sadly the movie feels underdeveloped. The way Tim Blake Nelson tries to compensate here is by having characters kind of spout the themes of the movie directly to the audience, including a very sort of conventional scene with Waterston as a professor lecturing to his students about suffering and despair and how poor decisions and godlessness send us down the wrong path. You know, and normally, like you, Nick, I do love movies with intersecting storylines with sad, desperate characters trying to find redemption.
That you just described my favorite movie of all time.
Of course, and one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. So, but Tim Blake Nelson really doesn't give us a whole lot that we haven't seen before, and very little is fleshed out enough for you to feel emotionally invested. And I mean, he doesn't judge any of these characters, and you know, there's some great moments. It's just kind of a waste of a good cast, particularly Kristen Stewart, who has a great speech about technology dependence that I kind of dug. But overall, it's a bit slow, and you know, despite its sort of existentialist viewpoint, I would just say watch Magnolia or Shortcuts again instead of this one. It's kind of a miss.
Okay, that's too bad.
Yeah,
but Omar's in it, So,
of course.
So that's Anesthesia, which is available on available on the on demand and on Amazon and the VOD possibilities and streaming stuff. All right, let's see, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you took the bullet this week, buddy.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, man, tell us about 50 Shades of Black. Oh, the title alone is just hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Really stretching that Marlon Wayans.
Yeah. By the way, I know you can't. I know you're, for some reason you can't stand Chris Hardwick, so you don't watch At Midnight.
Right.
Now, I watch it every night, and I watch it every night, and I love it.
Yeah.
He was on with two of the other cast members of 50 Shades of Black. And I didn't know it was possible for me to hate Marlon Wayans more.
Mm-hmm.
Then I saw him on At Midnight.
Yeah.
And after each one of his, now you've seen the show or you're familiar
oh,
with
it. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And Jim, you're familiar with the show, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So after, like, every time he buzzes in and does, gives a wacky, question or answer or whatever, he would laugh hysterically at his own stuff.
Okay.
So that just adds to the, I'm watching, I'm like, dude, don't, that's comedy 101.
You're pretty much reviewing the movie for me.
Oh.
In a way.
Okay, well, just.
Movie.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Black. Yeah. I'm assuming it's a satire of 50 Shades of Grey.
You would be correct, sir.
Oh, man, funny.
Yeah, okay. So if any movie is sort of screaming out for parody, it most certainly is 50 Shades of Grey, which, pretty much on its own terms is its own parody.
Oh, yeah.
Just nobody, it's the Congo of S&M romantic dramas. nobody told the cast that's supposed to be a comedy.
Okay.
No,
the cast knew. The director. The cast knew. The director didn't.
Okay, I get that weird theory mixed up.
Frank Marshall thought he was making a serious movie, and the cast knew it was a comedy.
Dylan Walsh didn't know anything.
The casting of Dylan Walsh was genius in that movie. You know how I feel about Congo.
I love Congo.
Okay, go
ahead. I know, that's so weird. But anyway, so here you go. You got, Marlon Wayans basically playing the Christian Black, not Christian Grey, part. And you have Callie Hawk in the Dakota Johnson role. And the movie, pretty much follows the same template. If you're familiar with 50 Shades of Grey, God help you, and you know how the movie transpired, the movie actually sort of follows the same plot in a way. I mean, one of the better things that I can actually say about this movie, which was Wayans didn't direct it.
No.
He just wrote it.
The dude who works with him co-wrote it and directed it. He also did the two Haunted House movies.
Yeah.
So it's like his buddy, his creative partner.
Right. So, like I said, the best compliment I can actually give this movie is that it actually doesn't follow that really horrible new trend that parody movies have, where they just sort of try to throw in as many jokes about other movies as possible.
Yeah.
And basically just repeating the same scenes, and because it's now in a comedy, it's supposed to be hilarious.
Right.
They really only do that a couple of times. They do some Magic Mike jokes, and there's one other movie that I'm already forgetting what other thing they were lifting from. But anyway, so it's a Wayans movie. It's a Marlon Wayans film.
Yeah.
And the next best thing I can say about it is that it's probably better than the second Haunted House movie.
Oh,
yeah, and it's probably better than any of those Friedberg Seltzer.
Right.
Whatever
epic movie.
It's better than all of those.
Okay.
I did chuckle three, maybe four times. Every once in a while, he sort of hits upon almost accidentally something that's just kind of semi-clever a bit. But there's so many things that you could do with 50 Shades of Grey that, you just imagine anyone with any sense of how to parody something and, everything that was so wrong with that movie. And it's basically just, him doing a lot of this is what black people would do, but white people wouldn't do kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you have to be a real special kind of satirist to actually get away with comparing the whipping scenes in 50 Shades of Grey to basically slavery movies.
Oh, God.
You know, so, you know, put that in the hands of, you know, a skilled satirist, it could have some real bite to it. Put it in the hands of Marlon Wayans, it looks like just like, oh, well, he sees a whip, he immediately thinks glory, you know. And that's the kind of stuff you have to sit through. And, it's got a lot of, you know, scatological humor. It's got a lot of body part humor, a lot of prosthetic penises flying all over the place. But it's a Marlon Wayans movie. That's really all you need to know going in. And the guy is just not funny. I don't know. Is he maybe the least talented of all the Wayans family members? I don't know. But it's not good. So it's better than those other movies, but it's not good, people.
Yeah. Well, now it didn't do well either over the. I mean, it did $6 million over the weekend.
No, people clearly saw the Haunted House movies and knew what they were in for with this one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I'm glad you saw it. I was hoping at some point when I got the email that, when I heard that you had seen it, I was like, oh, good, somebody did.
Yeah. I mean, you think, well, you know, considering, you know, how with all the nudity in, you know, the other movie, that you would at least, you know, play upon that, you know, but it's basically just like he goes for male nudity jokes rather than, you know, anything else, just full body nudity. It's just like, there's like one breast in like the entire movie.
Okay. So. All right. 50 Shades of. Now here's the question though, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Which movie is worse, 50 Shades of Black or 50 Shades of Grey?
50 Shades of Grey.
Is worse.
Yes.
Okay. Then this is a really bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right, Eric, hang on.
Okay.
Jim, hang on. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we got more movies to review, and we'll get a box office. We've been talking about box office here and there throughout the thing, and then we'll talk about the Sundance Film Festival. All right, it's Nick DiGilio here. We'll take a quick break on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here till 5 a.m. as we are every weekday morning. It's Monday morning, which means a little bit later on, my dad calls in and tells a joke because it's a jokey time. And it's Monday morning, which means it's movie review time. Jim Liskowski, who is filling in for Colin Suter, will be back in March. And Eric Childress and I are reviewing the new movies. So let's get back to that. Eric and Jim, welcome back.
All righty.
So am I right to understand that neither of you saw Son of Saul?
No, not yet.
Not all of it.
Not all of it.
I had some issues while watching it.
Oh. Okay.
Motion sickness issues.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
All right. Well, then I'll handle it. And Eric, if you want to jump in with whatever you saw of it, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's not a pleasant experience, this movie. It is a first-time director who actually really makes a pretty powerful statement. It's about a man who is in a concentration camp named Saul, played by Geza Rohrig. And the director of this movie and the co-writer, it's his first film, Laszlo Niemes, directed this movie and does it in a very odd. It's a very odd film, Eric, what you've seen of it.
Yeah.
When you hear about films about the Holocaust, you kind of have this predetermined notion as to what you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this is unlike any, concentration camp Holocaust film I've ever seen. Shot very interestingly and very strangely. Some of it gets muddled. Anyway, the plot is this Saul, who is in the concentration camp, is one of the prisoners who's being forced to help the Nazis exterminate Jews. And this will allow him to live longer. And it's one of the things. And he goes through this very emotionalist just kind of just being a cog in the machine. And this goes on for a while, and the supporting characters in the movie it's very strangely shot, like I said, and very underdeveloped. Sometimes you can't tell one person from the other, and that's where the movie gets a little bit muddy. But the crux of the movie is that he sees this boy die in the concentration camp. He's very, very, the kid is really, really ill, and he sees the kid get suffocated. And he's a Jewish boy, and he wants to make sure that this kid gets a proper Jewish burial. Meanwhile, there's an uprising that's being planned, and the conflict here is the Saul Will he try to actually get this kid a proper Jewish burial, or will he be a part of this uprising? And that's the crux of the emotional. That's the, sort of the emotional problem, or the thing that the main character goes through. I think it is definitely worth seeing. You got to be in a specific frame of mind. I saw it a long time ago, so you know, it did not make my top 20. Although I think it's a movie that's worth seeing. It's a hard movie to sit through. I do, however, think it will win the Best Foreign Film Oscar. So really interesting way it was shot. Good performance by the lead actor and a pretty strong debut directing job by Laszlo Nimes. It is, again, not the happiest movie in the world. It's devastating at times and sometimes hard to watch. But it's a unique take on a story that has been told many times before and done with, I think, a lot of power and originality, and definitely worth a look. So, Eric, you had issues.
Yeah, I mean, not issues necessarily with the film itself. I really can't cast any aspersions on the quality of the film itself, because what I've seen of it, I have, I think that there's absolutely merit to it.
Yeah.
It just, but you reference many times the way the film is shot.
Yeah.
And the film is shot basically almost in like a first-person narrative in a way.
Yep.
And like it's almost like you're playing a video game in a way. I mean, that's a little insensitive, but like you're playing a game, and it's that point of view. That character, and you're right there following him around everything that's going on. So like when I saw this, I was at the Toronto Film Festival, and I was watching this movie front row.
Oh, boy.
yeah, front row. And and by the time we got to the scene of the burning bodies, which is a shot really dark, and there's a lot going on in that scene, a lot to process. By that moment, I had to just kind of look away because I enjoy playing games and stuff, but sometimes if I'm playing something and the point of view is such to a point where I'm not sort of tuned in and noticing, you know, or occupied, and I'm just sort of watching the movement, I get a little queasy.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of felt watching Son of Saul. So I haven't had a chance to go back and finish it as a result of that.
Well, you know, I mean, it might be because I watched a screener of it, so so I wasn't. But I can understand why. I mean, look, I saw Cloverfield 3 feet away from the screen and almost puked like 80 times. So just in that regard, the way it's shot, I totally understand that. I mean, it's weird too because like the forced perspective like that, and that's pretty much what it is. It's a forced perspective, makes you you're concentrating on what the filmmaker wants you to see,
right?
And forces you in essence to see, and as a result of that, that to me is where the film gets muddy. Where like I mean, there were times when I was like, okay, wait, who's that guy?
Right.
Who is this person? It just seemed really it is a disorienting film. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
But I think with great merit and some really interesting filmmaking ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So and I really do think that is it the odds-on favorite to win?
I think so. I think that there might be. I mean, you know, sometimes the foreign film category can get sort of muddled to the point. You know, like the short film categories, like the best film never seems to win. You know, sometimes there always seems to be an upset, like, you know, maybe Mustang will pull through. But I think that the power, I mean, everyone seems to love Son of Saul and the subject matter. I do think it is the odds-on favorite.
Hey, you know, I watched the SAG Awards real quick before we break. Did you guys watch the SAG Awards?
No.
No, missed it.
Oh, okay, well, I watched it. I wasn't aware that Stallone wasn't even nominated. How did that happen?
It was just that was one of those things why there was some panic, especially by me, that there was a possibility that he might not get the Oscar nomination.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
And Elba won, correct?
I'm sorry? Yeah, he did. Idris Elba.
Yeah. And he's not nominated for the Oscar.
No, I know. It's weird.
So that kind of, I think that even more so kind of clears the path for Stallone.
It's interesting because here's the funny thing that I noticed. First of all, I watched it. It was fine. You know, you know, I mean, there's no hosts. The thing gets in at 2 hours, and it's live.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said. Maybe some of the other award shows should maybe look at the SAGs, you know, for ideas. And it didn't seem like people were being rushed through their speeches. I will say this. If there cannot be any complaints in terms of diversity when it came to the SAG Awards, Idris Elba, in fact, he won twice that night. Mm-hmm. And he came out to introduce the clip for Beast of No Nation with the kid from Beast of No Nation. And this was like right after Viola Davis had just won a SAG for mm-hmm. How to Get Away with Murder. And he just walks up to the mic and he goes, "Hey, welcome to Diverse TV." And everybody just went nuts.
I don't always like to throw cold water on this entire topic, but, you know, the voting apparently, like, closed on Friday for the SAG Awards. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this thing was, like, closed up, a month ago before
right.
all the stuff came out.
Right.
So it's very easy to all of a sudden, to
yeah.
make sure that the diverse angle comes through in, yeah. in the program.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. And you don't want to sound cynical, but that, that's the truth. It is. I mean, I was talking to my actor friends who were like, "Hey man, who should I vote for?"
Yeah.
Because they were doing the voting last week. So Jim, you were going to say something real quick.
Oh yeah. I was just going to say that should we just, placing our bets on Alicia Vikander now to win best supporting actress.
Even though it's a lead.
Yeah, well, I think that's what helps her. I think.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh yeah. No. It's the Timothy Hutton syndrome all over again.
Right.
Okay.
She was my small favorite.
Yeah.
Now she's probably my big favorite.
Oh yeah. No, I think so too. All right, guys, hang on a second. Okay, we'll come back and we got a break here. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. It is Monday morning, and that means a little bit later on, my dad will be calling in to tell a joke. Because it's a jokey time. Dan Shagru, my producer Dan, is going to give me and Esmeralda a little quiz on television catchphrases and their characters. So it'll be between me and Esmeralda. We're going to throw down. Mike it ugly. That'll be coming up in a little bit. But right now we're in the middle of the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski are joining me this week. And Eric just got back from Sundance, so we'll get a wrap-up of Sundance coming up in a little bit. But let's get back to the movie reviews. Here is Eric. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim.
Hello there.
Okay, Jim, you're going to tell us about... Now, first of all, I just got to say this. Dan and I ride in together. Dan is kind enough to pick me up, drive me in, and we drive in together, and we go and we drive home. Together. And we were driving home last week. It was last week, Dan, right? When we first saw that the giant billboard for this movie, and we were both like, "What the hell is Laser Team?" Is it Dan? Remember we saw it?
And there's two of them on our way.
There's two in like a 4-block radius downtown. You know, right by the Ohio Ontario feeder ramp. Right around
LaSalle, Illinois,
right at the corner there, and then like right at it's on Ohio, right?
On Ontario,
on the Ontario feeder ramp by what used to be Ed DeBevick's, right there, where Shadowbags had his remote. But anyway, so we look at him like, what is Laser Team? I had no idea what it was, never heard of it. At first, I was like, what is this? And we were trying to figure out what it was, and then we saw the first poster of it and was like, okay, well, maybe it's like a TV show. You know, I couldn't make it out. I didn't recognize anybody on it. The guys looked, the guys on it, on the poster, and we were driving, so it wasn't like we could stop and take a close look at it. They looked as though they may have been Hispanic, so I thought maybe it was something on Telemundo. I'm not kidding. And then we turned the corner and we got to a stoplight right by the old Ed Bevick's, and I got to look at it and it says in theaters, blah blah blah. And I'm like, what the hell is Laser Team? Now, are Dan and I missing something here, Eric? What is this a movie that people should know what it is?
No, not unless you are, you follow. Well, here's the thing is that I know Jim's going to get into it, but this movie, I guess, it premiered at the Fantastic Fest in Austin last September.
All right.
And it's put together by a group, Red Rooster or something.
Rooster. Like
it's the guy's responsible. If you've ever seen the Red versus Blue web series, which is basically they take like the Halo video game. And they just use the game as their own animation, and they put their own dialogue over it.
It's
really funny.
Okay, all right, it is funny, and I've not seen that. Okay, Jim, give us the 411. What are these guys called again, Jim?
They're called Rooster Teeth.
Rooster Teeth.
Rooster Teeth Productions. They've been around for like a decade or so, and they are based out of Austin, so it makes sense that this film would premiere there and probably a lot of fanboys were digging it. And I think this film also got some publicity for it being the most crowdfunded film of all time. It earned like $2.4 million through Indiegogo.
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's bound to maybe be a cult favorite amongst a certain demographic. But anyway, the plot is very simplistic. It's just the U.S. government is aware of alien life. There is a distant alien civilization that has agreed to send a weaponized suit to Earth in order to assist in the defense against another evil alien race. So in preparation for the suit's arrival, the U.S. government sort of breeds a super soldier with superior intelligence and physical prowess and trains him for years in preparation. Unfortunately, a group of four screw-ups accidentally blow up the spaceship that holds the suit out of the sky one night, and they each put on pieces of the suit, permanently binding them to each part of this alien super suit. And then the super soldier comes into contact with them and then realizes, like, oh, I guess I don't get to wear the suit the way I intended to, the way I've been training for my whole life. So now I have to train these four bumbling idiots and, basically get them ready for the big battle that's about to come when the intergalactic guests arrive. So this is kind of like a weird 80s hybrid. I don't know. You can sort of imagine maybe if the Broken Lizard guys remade Last Starfighter, only completely laugh-free. Comedy is subjective, and I know there's probably a faction of those out there who will find themselves very entertained, and Rooster Teeth probably has a huge following, but this is just completely uninspired. I mean, there's vomit sight gags and tennis balls to the groin. Lots of homophobia. it's just really base, crass humor that it was just not for me at all. The special effects, I mean, they look like they're out of Halo. They look like they're out of a video game, and really, really cheesy stuff, and not in a good, endearing way. Not something like Turbo Kid did last year. Mm-hmm. But I mean, maybe it's made for a certain fan base, and obviously this made a lot of money through Indiegogo for a reason. So I'm sure it's bound to please them, but I found it an absolute chore, and it's completely unfunny to me. Okay. So
yeah, all right. Well,
don't bother.
This is one of those. This is one of those. One of those things that's kind of lost on me.
It was completely lost on me.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Like maybe teenage boys will like it. I don't know. Funny.
Yeah, I just find it weird that they put up two gigantic billboards three blocks away from each other.
That's more billboards than theaters.
It has more billboards than theaters. You're absolutely right, and in River North, it's like these two giant billboards in River North. I'm like, is that your target audience? Is that Hooli? I guess they figure since a lot of people are getting on the Kennedy that they'll see it. I don't know. Okay.
So don't waste your time.
Laser team. Okay. All right. Let's see. Eric and Jim, you guys are going to handle Jane Got a Gun for me. I have not seen it. I'm interested in it. I didn't get a chance to see it over the weekend. It's got a great cast. Natalie Portman, Joe Edgerton, Ewan McGregor. It's directed by Gavin O'Connor, who, of course, directed Warrior. And it's a Western. Is it about Calamity Jane, Eric?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. So let's get that out of the way right now.
Yeah.
All right. It's called Jane Got a Gun, which I think is a very unfortunate title, considering there's an Aerosmith song called Janie Got a Gun.
Yeah.
But Jane Got a Gun, and it's just snuck in here. Does it have a bad history?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it does.
Okay.
Actually, I mean, it has a very, very interesting, very rich history. You got a couple of the elephants out of the room with the Aerosmith song, and that's not about Calamity Jane, but... Yeah. I'll get to the backstory in a second, here's what the movie is about. Natalie Portman plays a young frontiers woman. She has a daughter, and as the film opens, her husband, played by Noah Emmerich, comes home bullet ridden. She tends to him, and he warns her that the Bishop gang is coming for them. They're gonna kill them. Then through a series of flashbacks, we begin to fill in a little bit more of the pieces of the story. And we find that some 7 years earlier, Portman's Jane was a frontiers woman who was looking for safe passage, across across the country after her beau, played by Joel Edgerton, went off to war. He was presumed dead, so she moved on without him, her and her daughter, came across a gentleman played by Ewan McGregor, who was in charge of this, basically this wagon train that was going to get everyone from one place to the other. Over the course of time, Nora Emmerich's character ended up marrying her, and Joel Edgerton turned out not to be dead. She has tracked him down and is asking now for his help now that the Bishop Gang is coming to kill her and her husband. And naturally, he's reluctant because he believes she betrayed him and left him years ago. And, he's been searching for her ever since and then found out that she married another.
Okay, hang on. We got a break. When we come back, you can give us – that's your synopsis. When we come back, you give us your thoughts and Jim's thoughts on Jane Got a Gun, which is the new Western starring Natalie Portman. All right, and we'll get that coming up after we take a break here. All right. Good morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, 720 WGN. Hi. Your overnight dude. Here till 5, opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 a.m. All right, we're in the middle of the movie reviews here, the Monday morning movie reviews. Jim Leskowski and Eric Childress are joining me. And before the break, Eric told us all about the plot to Jane Got a Gun, which is the new Western starring Natalie Portman, Joel Edgerton, and Ewan McGregor. And so, Eric, you gave us the whole plot.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you said that there is a pretty interesting backstory about how this movie came to be, and then we want to hear what you and Jim think of it. So go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, okay. So here's the backstory to this thing is that the screenplay was on the, sort of the infamous the blacklist, which people don't know is sort of this list that Hollywood has of these sort of great unproduced screenplays that have just sort of lingered in limbo for some time. The screenplay, the film got off the ground and went into pre-production back in 2012. And it was Natalie Portman was always attached to star, and Lynn Ramsey, who had done We Need to Talk About Kevin, was attached to direct the film. Mm. On the first day of production, she left. She quit. This set off a whole bunch of legal problems between her and the studio. It was being co-financed by Relativity at the time, which has since gone bankrupt recently, went bankrupt last year. And then all these casting things started to come up. Joel Edgerton, who was originally hired to play the villain in the film, ended up switching roles to become Portman's ex. Jude Law then signed on to be part of the film, and then he quit because he just wanted to work with Lynn Ramsey. Bradley Cooper signed on. He was on for about 2 weeks, but then production was still stalled, so he had to leave to go film American Hustle. Eventually Ewan McGregor was cast in the role of the villain that Joel Edgerton was once going to play. And so basically after that you have the weirdest Star Wars prequel reunion in history.
Yeah.
Okay, so as for the movie itself, is the movie as bad as the Weinstein people would make you believe, considering that they didn't bother to show it for critics and they're just kind of sneaking this thing out to save face? No, it's not that bad. It's not nearly the type of film that you would expect to have this sort of treatment towards it. The performances by Portman, McGregor, and Edgerton are all quite good. Also by Noah Emmerich. It's beautifully shot in parts. The film's only about 90-some minutes, so it's not really that long. It sort of spins, the kind of Western yarn that you're, very familiar, but, because of the strength of the actors, definitely keeps you in it. But basically what this movie sort of comes down to is that if you saw the movie Slow West last year with Michael Fassbender, mm-hmm. It's kind of like watching Slow West if the entire movie was set at the house where the eventual ambush was going to happen instead of being on the road to the ambush.
Right.
So it's sort of like Slow West in reverse in a way. So then by the time you get to the ambush, it seems like we're about to have this really spectacular battle sequence at the end. And it starts off very promisingly, even though it's done completely in the dark, which is kind of a disappointing choice. And it just kind of peters out. And that's kind of how the movie just kind of peters out from there. It's like it's a lot of build up to just kind of a few sparks more than a big giant, you know, fireworks. So it's not that bad, but it's definitely the kind of thing that you'd rather wait to sort of catch on, you know, like a Sunday matinee at home on cable rather than venturing out to the theaters to go see.
Okay. All right, Jim, what do you think?
I completely concur with just about everything Eric said. I got the sense that maybe a fully realized director's cut could still exist. Like there's, like you mentioned, this flashback kind of narrative that feels a little bit tacked on at times, especially like this moment involving a hot air balloon ride. I was just kind of like, what's that doing in there?
Yes.
Seems kind of random. But on a couple of occasions that flashback does provide some context as to why this rivalry between all these men exists. So it wasn't a bad choice in terms of having it structured that way. But I thought the performances were good. It's definitely a mixed bag because that, the final confrontation, I wanted it to be a little bit more cathartic and intense, and it just does kind of peter out, and I was also thinking, you know, at the time, why is it in the dark, you know, because I kind of wanted to see a little bit more action take place at the end because it is building up to something like that, but, you know, I wish a stronger movie emerged from this, but, you know, if you are a fan of Westerns like Slow West, you could do a lot worse. It's nothing new, but it's still solid, I thought. So
okay.
I'm giving it a mild recommendation.
All right. Okay, cool. All right. Jim, tell us about The Finest Hours. Eric, you didn't see it, correct?
Did not.
Okay.
Yes. So this is based on a true story, a 1952 rescue mission of a four-man boat of Coast Guardsmen with very thick Boston accents, sent from Cape Cod to save the crew of the USS Pendleton, which is an oil tanker that had a brutal winter storm caused it to break in half off the coast of Nantucket. And playing the assistant engineer on the Pendleton is Casey Affleck, who hangs out over a lot of pipes and valves in the engine room for much of the film. But he's also very knowing, very knowledgeable than his fellow shipmen, and he attempts to convince them how to steer what's left of the tanker to safety. Meanwhile, on land is Chris Pine, a sort of timid, do-gooding guardsman who is happily making wedding plans when the storm sets in and news of the tanker's distress spreads. And his commanding officer, played by Eric Bana, dispatches Chris Pine into the freezing surf to search for survivors. A lot of this movie is very old-fashioned, especially in terms of its characterization. You can sort of at times draw the parallels between Casey Affleck and Chris Pine as being these resilient and knowledgeable and instinctive personalities. But, you know, I thought that the highlight of this film were just the highlights you would kind of expect in a sort of perfect storm-like setup. Scenes of peril and suspense kind of rescue this film, and you know, it's more of a spectacle in that regard. From the moment Chris Pine sets out, it becomes fairly riveting. The struggle to, you know, see what happens with the 33 surviving members of the tanker is really interesting, but there's also no overlooking the fact that the characters are pretty one-dimensional, and walking out of it, it's kind of forgettable. I was sort of reminded a little bit of last year's Everest, in which, you know, it has some intensity, it has some memorable set pieces, but I think it's marred a little bit by poor dialogue and just not getting a lot of insight into the individuals. But it gives us some escapist thrills. I thought it culminated, you know, really strongly when Chris Pine attempted to get his ship over the sandbar. And, you know, so it works for the most part, but again, it's kind of how I feel about Jane Got a Gun. It's just okay. It's mediocre at best, and I think that only those who are curious about the true story or interested in seeing a pretty remarkable rescue can venture out to see this.
Okay. All right, Jim, hang on. Eric, hang on. When we come back, I'll review it, and then we'll hang out with Eric for a little bit here, and he'll give us a rundown on some of the stuff that he saw at Sundance. Okay, when we come back, my review of The Finest Hours and the movie reviews continue right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're talking with Eric and we're talking with Jim, reviewing all the new movies. And then Eric's going to hang out with us and give us another rundown of some of the stuff that he saw at Sundance. He just got back from the Sundance Film Festival and gives us exclusive preview of what we're going to see. Also, Dan is going to put Esmeralda and I to the test. That'll be coming up. We'll be talking about TV characters and catchphrases and stuff like that. My dad will call in and tell a joke. So welcome back. Now, before the news, before we had to break, Jim told us about The Finest Hours, which is based on a true story. And it's a rescue film with the Coast Guard making an attempt to rescue oil tankers. Jim actually thought it was okay. It had moments. The effects and all that cool stuff is what was strongest. And Eric, Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Alrighty.
I actually like this movie a lot more than I thought I would. I went in with really low expectations. I'm one of the few people on the planet that hated A Perfect Storm. Hated it. And I know everybody loves that movie. Eric, did you like it?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And Jim?
It's all right.
Yeah, and I went in thinking, oh, God, this is what this is going to be. And I actually, you mentioned, you know, the best description that, you know, that you use two words to describe it, old-fashioned. This felt to me like a really old-fashioned film, a film that could have been, if they'd shot it in black and white, you know. And it just feels like a movie that you would see, like, on TCM in the middle of the afternoon. And I mean that as a compliment. So, you know, and I agree with you that the characters could have been more developed, that we've seen this story, despite the fact that this is an actual true story, that this happened to real people at a real time. They've made these kind of movies before, and the word old-fashioned comes to mind, because these kind of old, like, rescue films have been done a million times. I really thought this was well-directed, I thought it was well-done, and I thought the effects were unbelievable. And the sequences involving the special effects and the rescue attempts and the disastrous things that happen are done spectacularly well, considering, especially compared to that stupid whale movie that Opie made a couple of months ago, because that movie looked awful. I mean, you know, like the effects were so bad in that movie, but in this movie, they're seamless. They're beautifully done. From what I understand, I mean, Pixar did the effects for this movie.
It's a Disney film, so
I think they hired the guys from Pixar to do the effects. And I think this is the first. It's the first movie that Pixar has just basically been brought in to do special effects or CGI. And here's the deal: they need to be hired to do that more often. is the deal, because the effects, the sequences. I mean, Jim, there's some stunning stuff in this movie. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm recommending it, and you're talking to a guy who is just like, and again, I went in going, oh God, I thought it was going to be horrible, and I thought it was exciting. I thought it was actually well directed, oddly directed by the guy who directed Lars and the Real Girl. Doesn't seem like the kind of movie that he should direct, but
he also did the Fright Night remake, which is pretty good.
Yeah, he did the Fright Night remake, which was, I thought, terrific. So, Craig Gillespie is his name, and I really like this guy's work, and he shows that he can handle the big effects. You know, the human story itself, again, a little bit one-dimensional, but it didn't bother me that much because it felt like a sort of an old-school, old-fashioned, rousing adventure. I think it's the way that people felt about The Perfect Storm is the way I feel about this. It's like, I 20 years later, here's this movie, or 15 years later, or whatever it was, here's this movie. So I'm recommending The Finest Hours, and again, made no money, Eric, right?
Not as much as they would need. I mean, apparently the budget on this thing is pretty high.
Yeah.
The $10 million that it made this weekend is not really enough to get anyone excited over it.
Now, Jim, did you see it in 3D? Because I didn't.
I didn't, no.
Okay. I would imagine it would be kind of cool in 3D because the effects are so good and those sequences are pretty strong. I think it would be kind of cool in 3D, although I never recommend people go out and spend the extra $4 if they
I actually heard of a very strong recommendation against seen in 3D.
Okay.
One of our colleagues actually pretty much downgraded the movie because he had to see it in 3D.
Oh.
And said that it would have, you know, he enjoyed what was up on screen, but because it was a conversion job, that just made everything darker and murkier, and it was hard to
see that's,
things.
Well, okay, good. Then don't see it in 3D, because that's one of the, I mean, and it's true, because a lot of this takes place in the dark, or It's not bright. Yeah. It's not bright. And again, if you see it in 3D, that make you know that the images are going to be darker.
Yeah.
All right. So it wasn't. It was a conversion. It wasn't shot for 3D.
Right.
Okay. That's not good. Okay. Well, I liked it. I'm a fan. I thought The Finest Hours was good. If you're going to see it, hurry, because it's probably going to be gone. All right, Eric. What do we got next week?
Next week, we got Coen Brothers. We got Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
We got Hail Caesar. We got Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Yep.
And we got some Nicholas Sparks, too.
Oh, boy.
The Choice.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, I saw the commercials for that thing.
Yeah.
Good Lord. Hey, here's the thing about the Coen Brothers movie. All right? Mm-hmm. I adore the fact that it's the same studio that Barton Fink worked for. It's Capital.
I didn't even catch that.
It's Capital Pictures. It's Capital Pictures. I believe takes place after Barton Fink takes place, because I think this one takes place in the 50s. I think Barton Fink took place.
I don't know. I haven't checked, but maybe 40s.
Okay, because Barton Fink takes place in 41, so I don't know, but I'm guessing that. Michael Lerner's character got fired. That's my guess. Because it seems like Josh Brolin took over. So I that's what I think. I think Lipnick got fired. That's my that's my guess. But I love the fact that it's Capital Pictures. So
yeah.
And if Wallace Beery wrestling picture, what do you need, a roadmap? I'm really looking forward to it. The track record the Coen brothers have with George Clooney is not very good. That's just that's just me, because I'm the only person in the world that hates Oh Brother. So. All right.
Yeah, but you like Burn After Reading, I think, more than a lot of people do.
I did like Burn After Reading. Yes, that's true. I did like Burn After Reading. Yeah. Intolerable Cruelty. Ugh.
Not good.
Yeah. All right. All right, you guys. Jim, thanks again, buddy. And one more time, tell everybody where they can hear your podcasts.
Go check it out at nowplayingnetwork.net.
Nowplayingnetwork.net. Okay, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good, man.
All
Have a good week.
Okay, take care. There's Jim. Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
Are we breaking here? Oh, we're not breaking. All right. So it's time for Electric Boogaloo. All right, Eric.
Yes.
Sundance, you're back.
I am.
Overall, did you see mostly good movies or what?
No, I saw 27 movies while I was out there, I liked 10 of them.
You like 10 out of 27?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, 11 out of 28 if you count the one that I saw before I got out there.
All right. Well, you gave us some titles and talked a little bit about some of those movies. Jump on to the next one that you would like to share with us.
Okay. I pretty much mostly covered most of the good movies. Here's the movie that I got to see just before I left for Sundance, and it's a film called Nuts, and that's Nuts with an exclamation point. And you mentioned earlier about an animated documentary, and this is partially animated. And it's a documentary about a doctor back in the early part of the 20th century, who discovered that if he took goat testicles and put them inside of human males, it would increase their fertility levels. Okay? So this movie is about this the journey of this supposed quack who improved the sex lives of many men well before Viagra came out. Who basically his theories and practices were challenged and shot down by all of the doctors and the establishments of the time. And this movie goes, to a great and often hilarious lengths to show you the progress that his methods caused and how the eventual war with the establishment came about. And this is a fun little movie. It's a piece of history that I clearly didn't know about. It's hilariously animated at times, and it does feature a number of talking heads, people who actually do are aware of the what actually happened at the, to this guy, and it takes a great number of twists and turns, some really surprising stuff that comes out by the end of this movie.
Okay.
That sort of changes your entire perspective on a lot of the things that you hear just about this type of medicine that was being practiced back then. So it's a fun little documentary. It's called Nuts.
Okay. Well, on that note, we got a break. Okay, Eric?
Okay.
Hang on a second. Eric Childress is going to hang out with us, and we're going to hear more about his adventures at Sundance. I don't know if he should have led with that one, Dan. You think he should have led with a movie about testicles called Nuts?
For this show? Yes.
All right, we're going to break. That's why you produce this show, Dan. All right, we're going to break for, we got weather, we got traffic, and then more with Eric and Sundance.
All right. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. I'm your overnight dude, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. live right here on WGN. Eric Childress is with us, and we're talking about the Sundance Film Festival. And Eric just got back from that, saw 27 films while he was there. And only like 10 of them. All right, Eric, you can tell us about any of the other ones that you want to talk about here. Sundance.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, we're sort of in the more high profile miss categories at this point.
All right.
Of all the films that I saw that were misses, this next one is probably is the best of them.
Okay.
And it's a movie called Operation Avalanche. And this is a film made by the guys who did a film a few years ago called The Dirties. It was a film that actually played our very first festival. We chose it. And this one is another sort of faux documentary about the guys that were working for this CIA, this sort of this special, like almost like student branch of CIA geniuses that were handpicked from, you know, young guys. And their first job was to clear the prospect that Stanley Kubrick was actually a Russian spy. And for their next assignment, they sort of worm their way into figuring out how they're going to solve the potential moon landing that NASA is planning and may not be ready for. You can sort of see where this is going.
Yeah.
So basically the crux of this movie is them putting together a plan to fake the Apollo moon landing just in case NASA cannot get their stuff together in time. Like I said, this is done in a faux documentary style, so it has, you know, it's done in the film stock of the day, it's a movie that gets a bit better as it goes along. One of its biggest problems is that it really sort of takes too long to actually get to the crux of the moon landing fakery, which is what we really want to get to, it's kind of sporadically funny. Throughout that time, and once you get to they sort of kick in the moon landing stuff a bit more, it does produce a few more laughs, but it's still a little too stretched, and it just never quite it's too backloaded.
Okay.
Let's just say it's got some good ideas, it's got definitely some good scenes in it, it, like I said, by the end you kind of wish that the first act and a half were better.
You know,
Avalanche.
I'm wondering if there's something in the water, because between this and Moonwalkers, which was a movie we talked about a few weeks ago.
And Room 237.
And Room 237, I mean, you know, I think that they should re-release Capricorn 1. I think it's the right climate.
Seriously, you got the OJ thing coming out
this
week. And,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And the movie kicks ass, too.
Right.
Okay, what do we got next for some from Sundance?
We got a film called Indignation. And this is based on the Philip Roth book, and it stars Logan Lerman as a young Jewish man who's entering a university. He's got very set ideas against religion. His father is not very happy about him going off to college. He's entered a period of overburdens of worrying because people fellow Jewish boys have been dying in Korea at the time. This movie is set in the 1950s. He goes to college and he meets a young woman played by Sarah Gadon, who sort of, you know, he strikes a fancy with her and she kind of opens up his world, so to speak, a bit. But at the same time, he's challenging the status quo at the college. Mainly the headmaster, played by Tracy Letts.
Whoa.
Yeah, and with all Philip Roth adaptations to film, the few that we've had, it always sort of comes down to a lot of words in search of a meaning, put together, you know, in a way that by a guy that very much seems to be obsessed with sex, and that's kind of the feeling you get here. It's a lot of just jumbled pretension and stuff that, again, just never quite finds what it's trying to service and for what it's exactly trying to say. It's not paced particularly well. However, it gets to a point about 1 hour into the movie, there is a sequence between Logan Lerman and Tracy Letts, a dialogue sequence that actually lasts 16 minutes.
Whoa.
That's this sort of back-and-forth debate between the two of them in his office that is really quite spectacular. And you wish that the rest of the movie was like this sequence, and the last back half of it actually tries to do that sequence a couple times between other characters, and it never quite has the same power and focus as this thing between Lerman and Letts. It's a fantastic. It's like the best sequence in a not so good movie that I saw the entire festival.
Okay.
So it's a movie that will have sporadic interest. People who are big Roth fans will probably find more interest in it than I do. But that indignation was kind of a miss.
Okay.
Directed by James Shamus.
Right. James Shamus, who is Ang Lee's producer.
Correct.
Yeah. And it's making his film debut here. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because we're running out of time here. What were give me your top three your top three best and the single worst movie that you saw.
Okay. My top three going from three to one. My top three, South Side with You, which is the story of the Obamas' first date.
Right.
Really beautiful and sweet movie. My number two was Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea,
okay.
Which is going to get a lot of awards buzz by the end of the year if people attach themselves to it, Casey Affleck in particular. And my number one is John Carney's Sing Street, which was just complete joy from start to finish. The songs are still in my head. I can't wait to see it again. I actually saw the preview on Friday before Jane Got a Gun. And when the preview was over, I told people in the audience, you have to go see that movie.
Yeah. I'm very excited about it. Everything I hear has been extraordinary about that movie.
Yeah.
Okay. So
you're going to love it.
I can't wait to see it. Now, worst movie, the single worst movie.
Well, the single worst movie I saw was a movie called The Greasy Strangler.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I don't even need to go in and describe what the movie is, but it's basically an hour and a half sort of geek show,
yeah.
In a way, sort of a tolerance act trying to get you to leave the theater,
yeah.
Basically, or shut it off, whatever you do.
Yeah.
It's not funny. It's a complete mess. But, you know, you go into a movie like Greasy Strangler expecting to get that. You don't quite expect the same thing going into Kevin Smith's Yoga Hosers.
Oh, boy.
Which is certainly the most high-profile piece of garbage that I saw at Sundance this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually the last movie I saw. And so I left Sundance with a very sour taste in my mouth. Because Yoga Hosers, it's marginally better than Cop Out.
Oof. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Cop Out is about as lazy a film as has ever been made. Yoga Hosers is just horrible.
Wow. Okay.
Maybe not lazy, but horrible.
All right. Well, I appreciate all the reports, and everybody can read your stuff. They can check out Letterboxd with no E, letterboxd.com for your rankings, and you'll write more about it, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Eric.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy.
There's later.
Eric Childress giving us exclusive previews of everything from the Sundance Film Festival. All right, we'll take a quick break. We got the news coming up, and then Dan is going to quiz Esmeralda and I on our catchphrase knowledge. All right. All right. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN.